Hello and welcome. I'm Kirsten Johnston and I'm the chair of the Marketing Focus Group at the British Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai. This is our third episode of Season 2 in the Live Lounge podcast series, and today we bring you a fascinating broadcast about the benefits and challenges of managing cross-cultural teams in China. This is a mini-lounge podcast which is hosted by Stephen Proud, Global Marketing Director of Brandigo, an international brand strategy and marketing agency. He's joined by Peter Bomer, the former Asia-Pacific Regional Director of Johnnie Walker Whisky, and is now currently running two new businesses in China, including the China Hack and ePower Investment. Also in the lounge is Bessie Lee, who is the founder of Within Link and sits as Non-Exec Director of Electro Components PLC and United Communications Group. Additionally, Bessie was the former CEO of WPP in China. Together, this panel discusses the obstacles encountered when working in China under international corporate structures and the uniqueness of Chinese working practices versus other Asian regions. They offer stories and advice that will be of benefit to anyone hoping to succeed in China, working with cross-cultural teams or as part of international firms. So now I'll hand over to Stephen and his panel in the mini lounge.
So I thought a fun topic for, because compared to you guys, I'm relatively new here. I've been in China for 6 years now.
Oh, that's not too bad.
Not too bad, I guess. Mm. But I did 4 years in Beijing and I did...
You made it the four-year hurdle.
Yeah, 4 years in Beijing, 2 years Shanghai. I'm at the beginning of my managing cross-cultural teams, multicultural members of the team, things like that. You two are a little bit ahead of me in that game. I just thought it might be fun to talk about some of the challenges that businesses face or managers face, leaders face, when it comes to working in that multicultural environment.
Mm. Well, I mean, the biggest one, well, actually there are two and they're linked really. The first is that I'd read a lot about China before I came here. And if I'm honest, much of what I'd read wasn't wrong exactly, but it really failed to appreciate the sort of deeper meaning of the issue that it was highlighting, issues like Guanxi and relationships, yep, and their importance. Which actually are important, but they work in a completely different way to the way the Western literature would suggest. But I think the biggest, and it's related, issue for me was expectations. So my expectations of what a talented top team would do, how they would think, how they would act, were very, very different to the expectations of the teams I found myself working with here. And equally, their expectations of how I would conduct myself were fundamentally different.
That's interesting. Mm. Bessie, I'd love to ask you the same question.
Sure. I was relocated to China 17 years ago now by WPP. At that time, any expat, it was very natural for expats to bring his or her own troops from his or her home country with them.
Right. Right?
Not necessarily together, but eventually they will ship them over to become their core team in China. So when it comes to, you know, the team that you're leading and the core team that you're working with, there's no difference between working in your home country versus working in China because you're working with the same team. Now, 17 years ago when I was relocated, I didn't do that. Maybe because China is huge. And I just made an assumption that because it's huge, there's got to be enough talent for you to develop into your core team. Now, my core team in Taiwan, can they survive in a market that we're not familiar with? I don't know. I was new as well at the time. So I certainly did not want to, like, you know, superimpose something unfamiliar to my core team in Taiwan. So I didn't bring anyone with me. I decided to engage with 97 of them even before I moved. So I designed a little questionnaire and asked them to, well, send it to the PA here, and ask the PA to distribute to everyone and ask them to put a photo of them and then answer a few simple questions about themselves. And I started to sort of know or understand my team a little bit already before I moved.
What sort of questions did you have in that? Was it
like, you know, what's your hobbies? What do you think, you know, the company, how do you think the company is doing now? Where are the areas you think the company is doing well, but not doing so well? So I I'm sure after I arrived, most of the, my senior guys, you know, human nature, they're like, I'm going to wait and see how long this lady survived. Because before my time, the Shanghai office head had several changes. And then they've been looking for that Shanghai office head for probably 7 or 8 months. So that's how I started to develop my core team here. And the biggest challenge for me as Taiwanese coming to China to work really is to learn how to lead a multinational team. So for the first time, I had to manage English, Scottish, Australian, Japanese, Singaporean, Malaysian, Hong Kongese. It's a new territory. Mm-hmm. You just have to learn. For me, I just had to learn from ground zero.
It's interesting as well that you said that it was a lot of local hires. I don't think that is as common as you think. I see quite a few, I don't know whether it's a European or British or maybe an American thing, who they do still seem to ship a lot of people over with them and expect them to sort of sink and swim, sort of adapt or die, almost.
The experience at Diageo was not that dissimilar to Bessie's, in that there was a small core team, a fairly senior team, who came in together, who'd all worked together over a fairly long period of time, knew each other well, had to make things happen for the business here. But actually, right from the outset, we were fairly clear on the need to have local talent. And we were kind of steered fairly firmly in that direction anyway, because we're working with a JV here, JV between Hennessy and Diageo, which, if I remember rightly, Diageo had a 35% stake in, called Richmond at the time, although it's since changed. And so there was an absolute expectation that the business would be built with local colours and with local teams. So, you know, that was my experience also from the very outset. And of course, once I started running my own businesses, that became essential. Nobody international was terribly interested in working for a funky little startup in Shanghai. It wasn't really why most of them had come here. The challenges that we experienced were then a little bit different, but it was all about localness right from the very beginning.
When you said you were brought in with the team, did all the team have some international experience already, or were you assessed to have that cultural intelligence that's required? Well,
most of the people that came in one block had been overseas, moved around a fair bit, a lot of Asia experience. I'd spent a lot of time in Taiwan sorting out various issues that the Johnny Walker brand had run into there. A lot of the management team had been based in Singapore, looking after one of Diageo's Asian regions from there. So there was a lot of multinational experience. Having said that, I don't think anyone was quite ready for what China was going to throw at us, because it just was not the same in any way at all, just completely different.
I'd like to just spend a couple of minutes talking about relationships back with HQ and maybe other foreign entities. So my business at the moment, we have the office in Shanghai, we've got small operations in other places, and we have the other main office in Boston. And it's almost as big a challenge for me to manage or make Boston appreciate some of the stuff that we're doing here, and some of the flexibility that we need, and the differences between working, even down to on Skype, they never think in time zones. So it's even little things like that have an impact on the relationship with HQ.
Time zone or visa.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Well, the time zone thing was a non-issue for Diageo, in that it was absolutely expected that wherever you were in the world, if it was 3 a.m. in the morning and the board wanted you on the call, there you were.
Okay, so that's one way to get it. It's London time everywhere.
That's right, exactly right, yeah. I think we had two issues, really. The first one, and this is a very common one, I think anyone who's been in China from overseas for a long period of time will have run into this. It was incredibly difficult to get senior people back at corporate HQ to actually take on board just how different things are here. Mm-hmm. Things are so startlingly different, from big issues all the way down to everyday minutiae, that actually when you try and describe just how differently things work, you can sense the other person beginning to think, pleading, and you know what, that sounds a bit extreme, that doesn't sound plausible to me, I don't think I really believe that. And, you know, you're at that magic number, actually, 6 years in China.
Really?
In my experience, that's about how long it takes for people to really get their heads around, you know, the ways in which China is similar because people are people, and the ways in which China is fundamentally, utterly alien. So that was a big issue. And the other big issue was a sort of gradual loss of, perhaps I'm being a bit controversial, but a gradual loss of courage. So we entered the market with some pretty big ambitions, and we had some quite interesting plans and initiatives and strategies. And the initial corporate response to those was, that's absolutely fantastic. That's the kind of fresh thinking, fresh, bold thinking we need. Followed a month later by, you know, we're still right behind you, but it's a difficult, complex issue, so we're going to have to take a few weeks and really think it through. Followed by, well, we still want you to do this, but the budget's only going to be 60% of what we talked about. And, you know, eventually you end up in a position where inertia sort of grinds everything to a halt and really nothing very much happens. And, you know, I think that's an unfamiliarity thing. Must be very difficult from corporate HQ's perspective. You know this place is important. Everyone's telling you, even if you don't quite believe them, how different it is. You know for sure that you don't know what it's like. Pretty hard to be assertive and bold in those circumstances. Yeah. I don't know if it was at all the same with WPP for you.
I'm seeing more and more power play between headquarters and China.
Okay.
You know, the 17 years when I first arrived in China, China is a market, is like a little toddler. So for the multinational, the headquarters is like a parent, right? So they're like, oh, I'll take care of you. I'll parachute team to help you grow. I'll send in resources you need, but you'll listen to me because I'm the parent. But I think now China is a teenager and growing into a young adult. It's got great, bright potential, and this young adult knows about it. Parents don't like it.
Yeah.
So I'm seeing a lot more power plays between the headquarters and the Chinese team. Unless they move the headquarters key personnel to China and give them time to understand, if they don't do that, the power play between headquarters and local China is going to get more and more severe.
I think that's right. But the truth is that that's easier said than done. Because if you want to actually grasp something about Chinese culture, you need to immerse yourself in the history. Mm. You know, one of the startling things for me about China is, reached a state of quite advanced civilization very early, has ever since then had an almost unassailable view of itself as being culturally really as good as it gets. And, you know, with all of this sort of unspoken implications that other approaches and ways of thinking and mindsets are perhaps not quite as superior. Oh. And if you're going to even begin to navigate that, you need to actually know a little about the history. You need to speak the language to a reasonable degree and also recognise that you'll never speak it well enough to really get on exact level terms with people here. And it's a vast undertaking. So you were talking earlier about the size of the country. I suppose I'm talking about the size of the past. And those two things together have a huge influence on how people think and act today, right now. Unless you can begin to wrap your head around that, it's very difficult to make things work here.
Did you ever manage to get your CEO or whoever it was to actually come and spend a decent amount of time, boots on the ground?
Depends what you mean by a decent amount of time.
Well, so you talk about you have to be here to experience it and things like that. There's a lot of clients that I work with that they've got senior marketing people here, but they are always expected to go back to the States, back to Europe, back to the UK, where have you, to have that regular meeting, and they probably spend a couple of months, and it's never the other way around. And I always think it would be hugely beneficial to maybe have that AGM here and have some of those seniors here for a month, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, whatever it is, and kind of get beyond the meeting room, but really have some of that. I know you're only going to get paid lip service, but it's still going to help that understanding a little bit.
In fairness, Diageo did that a lot.
Okay.
And the problem, I think, is just that you can't do it enough. It's not sufficient. I mean, it's great that they did that, and it obviously helps. And I know in WPP's case, Sir Martin Sorrell was a pretty regular visitor here, and
yeah,
no doubt
average,
still is.
On average, he will do 6 or 7 trips a year.
Okay, yeah.
To China. I think because that frequent trips he's taken to China, he, among all the other holding groups, level CEOs, he probably appreciated China much better. And I think for a long period of time, he was an advocate of China,
right.
As well. So that visit by global CEO is it's got its value. But again, to have a real, you know, rather than just a superficial appreciation of the market, but to have a real understanding and insights of the market, the dipstick visit
doesn't really work, does it?
No,
and you have to go beyond that. A lot of the people in the first team I worked with here were here on 2 to 3 year contracts, and myself included when I first arrived. Mm-hmm. And they were perhaps, in many cases, here more because it was a great career move to have done it. And I'm not sure the long-term interest and fascination with China was ever there. And actually, I think you need to be a lover of China. You need to have a genuine fascination for the place.
Yeah.
And those that do tend to stick around. And actually, in my experience, quite often they end up starting their own businesses and doing arguably a lot better than the big corporates. And it's not perhaps surprising that they do that because they're liberating themselves from a lot of the issues we've been talking about.
Sure.
This morning. We've certainly both done that and know a lot of other people who've done exactly the same thing. So you've got to be a China lover. You've got to have a genuine passion for the place. And that doesn't necessarily sit very easily within a corporate career structure.
And also for people who manage a global portfolio, like a global CEO, if let's say your headquarters is in London, and if the CEO still have the mindset or the mentality or his core team having the same mentality that everything or all initiative has to come out of London, actually you're missing a big trick.
Hmm.
Or you're missing big time.
Hmm.
The benefit you're going to get by leveraging this true global network. And I'm not just saying everything coming out of China. China certainly, in certain areas, are leading the world, like mobile payment, customer lifetime value, engagement, like what WeChat has done, hijacking our everyday life. But Japan actually, because of the aging society, is very, very advanced in robotic.
Mm.
So if you're in an industry or if you believe that robotic is going to have some application or implication or impact to your industry, why not give your local team in Japan an initiative surrounding robotic and put the China team on top of mobile and mobile related and mobile first, artificial intelligence? Mm. Only when you do that, then you're actually maximizing the benefit of a global portfolio. Otherwise, everything has to come out of your headquarters, whether it's in London or New York.
That's fascinating.
It's true.
What, it takes forever.
It's true. It's
second
true.
Of all, what eventually may happen, it's probably already history.
But what you're saying is particularly true, I think, about China, because China has this extraordinary ability to do what would you call it, a sort of scruffy innovation. So moving incredibly fast to try everything, not necessarily having the brilliant master plan, which is then developed over many, many months, but just trying something to see if it works a bit and then moving very swiftly on to the next thing. And the permutations get played out incredibly quickly. But, there are real capacities here that aren't actually used. And I think the issue perhaps is trust. So I think, corporate teams are more willing to put that kind of trust into a market like Japan than they would be here.
That's interesting.
And I can understand, because it's partly an issue of the sort of difficulties of actually truly engaging with China, all the things we've been talking about. And it's also something to do with, the earlier phases where, corruption was a byword and so on. But things have changed a great deal here, and I'm not saying that everything is fundamentally squeakily wonderful any more than it is anywhere else in the world, but actually I think you could place that kind of trust here, and I think people should. I mean, you look at an example like Tencent, who have been absolutely unbelievably fertile in throwing out new ideas and new products. Many of which have failed, but those that haven't failed have been absolutely game-changing. And, they have hands-on engagement right from the very top of the company, the whole way through. There's this extraordinarily sort of entrepreneurial approach. And, yes, huge asset potentially to other countries, other economies. No one's quite been brave enough or clear enough on how to sort of grasp just yet.
Okay, let's just move things on to something slightly different. maybe more of an operations side now. So I did a piece of work recently where I interviewed about 20 country leads of UK companies in China. And I think maybe 17 of those 20 told me they have a completely different structure to their organization as they would in any of their other territories. And a lot of them that have the same structure in multiple, but it's different here, or some of the smarter ones will have a different structure within each of the different territories. And it just makes it work quicker, makes it work more effectively. So I'd be interested to just throw that to you two as well. With Diageo, for example, was it structurally the same? Was the same hierarchy? Was the same lines of reporting or anything like that? Or were you tweaking it to make it more successful?
Well, I think in many ways what I've done since is more relevant, but just to sort of address that briefly, Diageo was a modern Western company, so not very hung up on its structure and hierarchy, and yet structural and hierarchical, working with a JV partner who were very Chinese and old school Chinese at that, so very hierarchical and structural, and you know, throw in the middle of that the inevitable tensions between the two parties, it all got a bit difficult.
So was the JV a common way for the Diageo? So, because the JV could be a structural solution, if you like. So a lot of companies will do a JV to...
Well, it was a structure. I'm not so sure about the solution part, but yes, that was very much. And again, you have to recall this is going back quite a while, but this is very much how Diageo worked around Asia. But what I was going to go on to say is that since Diageo, most of my time has been spent managing teams of 50, 60 people, and that is a completely different game, of course, because without being a micromanager, and it's very important that you try not to be that at all, you are able to have an active involvement in everything with everyone. And then if you know what you're doing, it's relatively easy to stimulate this sense of we're just a group of people who are cracking on with a problem together. And that's an amazingly rewarding and productive way of doing things. It's difficult to scale, but these days I'm a big believer that small is beautiful. So for me, that hasn't been an issue. I mean, your team is a similar sort of size right now, but you, I guess, have got sort of expansion plans ahead. So maybe your view on this is more.
My observation of several of my clients, those who survive the economy slowdown in China, tend to be those clients who continue to try different things, different organization structure, and do it quietly in China too. Because if this is a domestic organization structure change, I don't really need to let the headquarters know.
Right.
Let me just try it. So for instance, one of my FMCG clients just decided internally, why don't we just set up a team, give a few brands, smaller brands to this team leader, also throw in e-commerce operation, throwing data access to this lady, and throwing PR, you know, it's like everything, all disciplines under the same roof, and just go and play.
Mm-hmm.
And she did it brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that division, even in the economic slowdown, was the fastest growing division.
Mm-hmm.
Because finally, in that team, data is talking to marketing.
Yeah, I think you make a wonderful point. It's back to that flexibility and fleetness of foot that's a real sort of strength of the place, and not putting anything in the way of doing that, just allowing it to happen.
Yeah.
If it ain't working, no one is faster than a Chinese team at spotting that and making an adjustment.
I am going to go for one more question, and I'm going to put you guys on the spot a little bit. I was going to ask you horror stories, but I'm not going to do that because I think it's been fun. I don't want to go over old bad memories or anything like that, but I would put you guys on your spot for your kind of your biggest lesson or your biggest piece of advice that you would give to an overseas company who are either thinking of setting up, coming to China, or are here and perhaps facing some challenges. What would be the big piece of advice you'd give them?
I'll talk about the areas to watch out for, because I had a major failure running Guben, which is the largest operating company under WPP. If you're only just arriving in China, a lot of the very standard and basic business conduct that you took for granted elsewhere, it is not happening the same way in China. For instance, payment term. Nobody pays on time. Okay? So if you're like in everywhere else, you, especially you came from a more advanced market where, or mature market where people honor their payment term commitment, they pay on time, certainly not here. And never trust the contract you sign, because they can sign a contract and they still delay your payment. So, you know, basic things like that. Now, why I said that it was my biggest failure as a Group M CEO and WPP, it's not about payment term, but it's about at the back end, because our business grew very quickly, but our back end system hasn't caught up. Meaning, we didn't have a robust financial system to record all the financial movement, you know, payment, you know, collections and payment in, payment out. But of course, we at the front end are leading the business development. We tend to believe, your finance team, they're all like, you know, very professional. They definitely got it taken care of. So we never actually look back and deep dive into, do we have a robust back-end system to record everything? We didn't. So I remember it was, this was 12 years ago already, we had a change of CFO. So the new CFO came in, dived deeper and deeper, and she realized, and then she came to me and she said, you know what, we have 40 billion RMB worth of mismatched records, financial records.
40 billion?
Yeah, I'm like, huh? Excuse me? Say that again? So she walked me through what happened. With mismatch record, you have to cleanse the record, of course, right? It took the entire team 2 full years. Thank God that 2 years later, when we finally clean up the 40 billion records, not only we didn't have loss, we actually had gain. But I tell you, those 2 years, especially the first 3 months, ever since the episode was revealed, every day I woke up thinking, I'm going to get fired. Walking into the office, I'm going to get fired. It's fundamental things like that.
Yeah.
You would think that people, you know, will do it, but they find it overwhelming as well. And nobody wants to come to report that to you. Because they're like, I don't want to be the bad guy or bring the bad news to the CEO, to the big boss, right? So it's fundamental things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And advice-wise, if you haven't entered China as a brand, as a company, if you're a consumer product, a consumer brand, you don't necessarily have to start in Beijing, Shanghai, or Guangzhou.
Yeah.
You start in a lower tier city.
Be much wiser to start in a lower tier city.
Exactly. So, you know, a piece of advice in terms of market expansion.
I agree with that. Look, I haven't got a story that's quite as dramatic as that one, but in some ways that's a story about not being able to make any assumptions at all about what can and can't be relied upon here. And I think that is fantastic general advice. I'm going to extend that into the area of people, because my experience has been that although everything can be a bit awkward, tricky, and ultimately in China, anything you want to do, you can pretty much do, but it ain't always a smooth ride. But what I found was that most of my time was spent dealing with people. And by that, I mean finding the right people, because that's the absolute fundamental requirement for any successful team, and it's much harder to do here. And then finding a way to get people to leave behind what I think historically has been quite a task-based approach to the world, and to get them to think about outcomes that they're pursuing and to take enough personal ownership of those that they are actually willing to not wait for somebody else to come and take action, but that they're going to sort of start anticipating what they can do. And even more, the sort of openness that's required to hold your hand up and say, actually, this has all gone horribly wrong, so that you can A, do something about it, and B, learn the lessons.
Yeah.
And, you know, people talk a lot about relationships and how important they are here. Getting that kind of working mindset in every single environment I've worked in here is the single biggest challenge by far. And it's a very difficult one for a Westerner, because we have a sort of instinctive understanding that There's personal and there's business, and actually they can merge a lot.
Yeah.
So you can work in a British business and get along like a house on fire on a friendship basis, but everybody understands that at certain points, friendship stops, business takes over, and it can be quite hard-nosed from time to time. And that's not a conflict or a difficult thing for anyone to grapple with or grasp. It doesn't work like that here. So one of the things you have to be very, very careful about is in building great relationships with your team, and you have to do that if you want to get them thinking in different ways, not to allow them to switch into personal friendship mode as opposed to business mode, because once it's a personal friendship relationship, business rather easily goes out of the window, and then it becomes very, very difficult to manage the hiccups and the difficulties and the challenges that you're inevitably going to face along the way. So you can't make an assumption about being able to flip from business focus here to let's all go out and have a lovely dinner together here. You've got to be incredibly careful about that dividing line. And consequences are pretty severe if you get that wrong, in my experience.
Bessie, Peter, that's great. We've gone through all my questions. Really appreciate your time. That was really valuable. And thank you both very much.
Thank you.
It's been great fun. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
And that concludes our third episode of Season 2 of the Live Lounge podcast series. If you'd like to get in touch with any of the people who participated in this episode, or if you have a business topic you would like to hear about in our future episodes, please do contact us at the British Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai. My name is Kirsten Johnston. Thank you for listening.